Good morning. Today is Friday, October 19th, and the time is now 10:15 a.m., and I now call this meeting of the Finance Commission to order pursuant to Chapter 551 of the Government Code. Molly Curl, Cliff McCauley, and Matt Moore have all contacted me and indicated that they would not be able to attend this meeting and have requested that their absences be excused. In accordance with the Finance Code 11.103, the Commission members will take a vote to either accept or deny this request. Before I call for the vote, let me just explain. Molly was involved in a trip that required her to travel today, which is why Lori took her place. Cliff McCauley, our newest member, had advised me when he was appointed that he had a conflict with this meeting and would be unable to attend. And then Matt Moore also had a family conflict. And so given that, we'll take a vote to accept or deny this request. All in favor of excusing the absence, say aye.
Aye.
Any of those opposed, say nay. The ayes have it, and the absences are excused for the record. And there is a quorum today with eight members present. A few comments I'd like to make this morning. First things first, we have the pleasure of some guest attendees this morning. I'd like to welcome Sarah Wolf, who is our new AG office liaison representative, and her superior here, Nicole Bunker Henderson. I appreciate them being here this morning. Thank you very much. Thank you in advance for keeping us legal. We're really counting on you to help us there, so we look forward to working with you and arranging things in the future. Thank you. Secondly, there's no live stream this morning. As you all know, we're at the Capitol today, and we're all a little bit out of our typical element. So if everything seems a little disjointed this morning, I apologize, but it's just a little off base for us. So we are doing our typical recording, but no live stream for this meeting and for the December meeting, being that we'll be meeting here both meetings. Third thing I'd like to point out is in the Finance Commission materials on page 3 under that tab, you will see the future meeting dates for next year. Of course, our next meeting is December 14th, but February 15th falls the week of Valentine's Day. I might advise any commission members to secure lodging in advance. That is a very popular week to be in a hotel. April, June, August, October, and December, all the meeting dates are posted. And so you can arrange your lodging and travel, but please add those to your schedule so you're aware of our upcoming meetings.
Madam Chair, the April 12th, too, is during the legislative session, which makes up.
Yes, it does. It adds just a whole new element of fun to the whole process. Yes.
Hotel scarcity. Is also for the
15th and the 12th. It's just scarce in general, but it gets particularly scarce, especially in months like this, for example. Last thing I wanted to comment on were just some a general sunset update from some confusion and some questions from the members that I thought might be of assistance. And I think everybody realizes that the hearing was on 8/29 and that information has been disseminated and everybody's aware of where things stand. I think a lot of the questions were the path forward and what the next steps are. And so what I thought might be helpful is from here on forward, the next step is, of course, a sunset bill being drafted. And there are some important dates with respect to that that I thought I would share with the Commission this morning for your benefit on this topic. So first legislative day session is January 8th. And then as far as the bill filing deadline for unrestricted bills, that is on March 8th. And then the session ends on May 27th. So in answer to the many inquiries that I've had as to when we will have some resolution on the sunset issue, essentially that would be at the latest May 27th or earlier potentially. And we do have sunset on the agenda to be discussed further. Bills can be filed beginning on November 12th. So potentially that activity could start then and continues all the way until that March deadline that I mentioned. Moving on to regular commission business, the minutes are on the consent agenda. And so with respect to public comment, if there is anybody wishing to address the commission during the time of public comment, please fill out a witness affidavit form and bring it up front. Public comments on non-agenda items are limited to 5 minutes, and on agenda items are 10 minutes. We don't have any at this point, right? Okay. Moving on. Agenda item 3 is the consent agenda. And so, members, before we take up the consent agenda items, which are A1, B2, B3, B4, B5, and B6, D2 and D3 in a single vote, I want to state that any commission member may request that an agenda item be removed from the consent agenda and placed on the regular agenda so that it may be discussed and voted on individually. Hearing no objections from any members, do I hear a motion to adopt consent agenda items A1, B2, B3, B4, B5, B6, D2, and D3 without discussion?
So moved.
So moved by Philip. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Lori. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion passes. Moving on to agenda item 4, Finance Commission Operations. Commissioner Creeper.
Well, just a few minor things. As you know, we're doing some construction at our building, deferred maintenance, and the elevator has been out, and the boiler has been out. The boiler will be hopefully back in action on November the 1st, so just a few more weeks. And then the elevator, which is probably the most problematic, will be done sometime, hopefully in mid-November, or excuse me, mid-December, or maybe the 1st of December. They appear to be working ahead of schedule, I talked to one of the people yesterday, and they said so far so good. The rain kind of delayed them a little bit, but it really hasn't been that big of a problem. And we've been able to, at least we're on the third floor, and we've been able to work around it. And the employees have been going up the stairs, and so far so good. But we'd be glad to get that back up and going. I think Leslie mentioned earlier that the agency reports, financial reports were submitted in September, and y'all had a direct link to those, I believe, and the SDSI reports that we do will be due by the end of the month. I think some agencies have already submitted those, and that's really it.
Okay, thank you. Is there a potential possibility that things might be done, that we could have our December meeting back in the building?
I believe because of the posting time, we're going to miss it, but we'll be very close.
Okay. Rats, well, I thought I'd ask. Okay. Thank you. Moving on to agenda item 5, which is the audit committee report. And thank you, Lori, in advance for stepping in on some very heavy lifting in the audit committee meeting for Molly's absence.
You're welcome.
Okay, the Audit Committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the agency's August 31, 2018 investment officer reports.
Coming upon recommendation from the Audit Committee, no second is needed. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion passes.
The Audit Committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the agency's 2018 fourth quarter financial statements.
Coming upon recommendation from the Audit Committee, no second is needed. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion passes.
The Audit Committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve an additional Finance Commission audit to be provided under the current internal auditor contract.
Coming upon recommendation from the Audit Committee, no second is needed. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion passes.
And then the Audit Committee would also like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending's contribution of $750,000 to the Texas Financial Education Endowment Fund.
Coming upon recommendation from the Audit Committee, no second is needed. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion passes. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Moving on to agenda item 6, discussion of and possible vote to accept the report on the financial condition of the state banking system, which you all should have a copy of that looks like this. And, Kurt, if you would.
Anybody need a copy?
Okay. Good morning. Kurt Purdom. I'm the Director of Bank and Trust Supervision for the Texas Department of Banking. I'm sorry we don't have a placemat format of the report to hand out, but we're probably going to work on that maybe for next time. Before I get started, though, let me give credit where credit is due. And Gordon Anderson. Gordon, would you stand up? Gordon did most of the heavy lifting on this, most of the research and drafting on it, with input from Phil Lena, Mark Largent, and Teresa Nelson with the Savings and Mortgage Lending. By the way, this report is also available on our website. And so now getting into the report, so before I talk about the banking industry, I thought it appropriate to talk about the economy first. So let's move on to the economy. Overall, the Texas economy shows strong growth year-to-date in 2018. Both the U.S. economy and the Texas economy, consumer confidence remains high and inflation is in check. Chicago Fed President Evans recently described the U.S. economy as firing on all cylinders, and that's kind of how I would describe it. The Texas economy surpasses the nation in several metrics, including job creation, GDP growth, exports, population growth, and many of the housing industry measures. Moving on to job creation, in the nation, from September of 2017 to September 2018, in the U.S., there were 2.5 million jobs created. Texas employment is expanding at almost twice the national rate at 3.2% compared to 1.7%. That's through August. And year over year through August, Texas added 395,000 jobs, more than any other state. Close behind were California at 349,000 jobs and Florida at 220,000 jobs. As far as the numbers of jobs, professional and business services led the way at 92,000 jobs, followed by trade, transportation, and utilities at 66,000 jobs. And then after that, it was construction, which includes mining, and so that would be the oil and gas industry with 55,000 jobs. As you might expect, construction and logging and mining had the highest growth rate. The unemployment rate, the U.S. unemployment rate dipped down to 3.7% in September, and that's the lowest level it's been since 1969.
Oh my God.
Now, the most recent number that we have for Texas is only through August, but it's been tracking closely with the national unemployment rate, and right now the Texas unemployment rate is 3.9%. As far as GDP growth or gross domestic product growth, the U.S. GDP growth for the first quarter was 2.2% and 4.2% for the second quarter. Texas' real GDP growth for the first quarter was 2.9%, so we exceeded the national average. And our ranking was sixth in the nation behind only Washington State, Utah, South Dakota, Colorado, and Wyoming. Texas GDP growth for the second quarter won't be available till mid-November. From a dollar standpoint, only California produced more GDP growth in 2017 and the first quarter of 2018 than Texas did. The Atlanta Fed predicts or forecasts that the U.S. GDP growth for the third quarter for the nation was going to be 4.1%, but that won't be available until October 26. As far as other indicators of the economy, the Texas Business Cycle Index is going up. It's 3.4% above the December 2017 mark. The Texas Leading Index, however, which measures the future direction of the Texas economy, shows a slightly declining trend. Through the second quarter, it's 1.2% lower after several months of increases. The cause of the decline is a surge in the Texas trade-weighted value of the dollar and a decline in the Help Wanted Advertising Index. And if you were wondering what the Texas trade-weighted value of the dollar is, it's the value of the dollar against currencies that Texas exports to. And so when the value of our dollar goes up compared to our trading partners, it's harder to trade with them, of course. The leading index is declining a little bit, and that's one of the reasons why the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas predicts a possible cooling off of the Texas economy in the second half of 2018. Texas also benefited from population growth. Texas had some of the highest population growth in the nation. Most recent data from the Census Bureau estimates the state's population at 28 million, a 12.6% increase over the 2010 census. The Prima Group predicts that the Texas population will reach 30.5 million by 2022. By the way, the city of Frisco led the nation in growth at 8.2%. As far as housing continues to expand. Home sales are high, but inventories are low, which may cause some cooling off in the latter part of the year. After a sluggish first half of the year, the Texas housing sales rebounded 3.8%, reaching a record level of 29,456 homes sold through the MLS. Home prices between $200,000 and $300,000 account for most of the improvement. All the major metro areas are seeing growth. Only 3.6 months of inventory exist. It's believed that around 6 months is considered a balanced market. The biggest shortages are in the lower-priced homes, those below $200,000. The average days on the market also dropped to 56 days. In Fort Worth, homes are flying off the market in only 37 days. Texas led the nation in single-family building permits issued through July of this year and accounted for more than 16% of the national total. Houston led the way with 3,589 permits issued, followed by closely by Dallas-Fort Worth. Moving on to interest rates, of course, interest rates affect the number of houses sold, and rates continue to climb. The Federal Open Market Committee raised their target Fed funds rate to between 2% and 2.5% on September 27th. The 10-year Treasury is now above the 3% mark. Most analysts predict that the Fed will continue to raise interest rates one more time in 2018 and probably into 2019 until a neutral position is met. Of course, those changes in interest rates puts pressure on our banks to manage their interest rate risk. As far as exports, Texas is the top exporting state in the nation and accounts for 19% of the U.S. exports. If Texas were a country, we would be the 19th largest global exporter. Petroleum products and computer and electronics account for 17% and 16% of the exports. Mexico remains our top trading partner, receiving 35% of our exports. And, of course, y'all probably have read that the U.S., Canada, and Mexico reached an agreement this month. That deal is expected to be signed by the end of November, and then it will head to Congress for approval. As far as farming, farming conditions, we had drought conditions up through August for a big part of the state. And then now, of course, you know that we have a very wet fall. And so that's creating havoc for a lot of our cotton farmers, especially up in the Lubbock area, trying to get their crops out of the ground. So they were hit by drought. Now they're hit by not being able to get into the fields to harvest their crops. So that's an issue. The U.S. Department of Agriculture projects that inflation-adjusted net farm income will decrease about 15% in 2018 after it increased 20% in 2017. Though farm receipts are expected to be about the same as 2017, expenses for things such as fuel, interest, feed, and labor expected to increase. Of course, China's tariff on U.S. soybeans will affect U.S. soy or Texas farmers that produce soybeans. It's projected that Texas will produce about $61 million worth of this crop this year. China is the world's largest buyer of U.S. soybeans. On a positive note, Texas rice farmers are experiencing near record yields, and we've seen some improvement on some of the commodity prices, but unfortunately that's been caused by hurricane damage. As far as the oil and gas sector, I'm not going to go into that a lot, but the rig count remains good and stable. West Texas Intermediate is hovering around $70 a barrel. It slipped recently to build up in crude inventories. Also, there's been in a recent survey by the Dallas Fed, they're starting to get more comments back about pipeline disruptions. In other words, there's not enough pipeline to send the oil that we're producing to the refineries. As far as the state budget, according to the Texas Comptroller, when the legislature convenes in January, they'll be facing a $4 billion budget gap for the biennium that ends August 31st, 2019. That budget gap includes $2 billion in additional Medicaid expenses and an estimated $1 billion in Hurricane Harvey expenses. The good news is that the Texas Comptroller also increased his estimate of unappropriated revenue to $2.7 billion, thanks to higher tax collections. And by the way, taxes on oil are 73% higher this year than they were in 2017. Natural gas taxes are 41% higher. For the first 7 months of 2018, the state collected $34.9 billion, an increase of 11.6% over last year. Not going to say a whole lot about Hurricane Harvey, but last year, a little bit over a year ago, we had a Hurricane Harvey effects. There's still several Texas residents are struggling with that. A recent survey of the 24 storm-affected counties found that 8% of residents displaced from their homes were still not back in their homes, and one out of five of those whose homes were damaged say that their present living conditions are unsafe. So we still have some issues with Hurricane Harvey. In summary, although the Texas economy continued its broad expansion in the first half of 2018, there are some downside risks that may result in a cooling off period in the second half of the year. An extremely tight labor market. The unemployment rate is so low. Potential international trade issues, of course not with Mexico or Canada, but other trading partners. A very tight housing market, ag problems, and of course, as the stimulus for Hurricane Harvey insurance payments runs out, that will could have a slowing effect on the economy. Moving on to the banking system. Overall, banks and thrifts are faring very well in this economy, though we continue to see consolidation in the industry. Nationwide, there are 245 fewer banks, which is a 4.2% decrease over this time last year. The good news is we've had 21 de novo applications filed through September 2018, which is already twice the number that we had last year. Four of those have been approved, two have been returned, and three have been withdrawn. So we'll see how the rest of those turn out. As of June 30th, there were 448 commercial banks and thrifts chartered in Texas, both state and national charter. So Texas charters have reduced by eight from a year ago, which is only a 1.8% decrease. And again, the national rate was over 4%. Ours is less than 2%. On a good note, the Texas Department of Banking picked up five of those eight charters due to merger. We continue to see primarily the smaller banks going through merger. Of the eight banks and thrifts that merged out, five of those were under $500 million. And I've got some more information on merger activity and the drivers behind that, but I think I'm going to skip that today. As far as branch activity, compared to this time last year, there are 85 fewer branches in Texas, so we're down to 6,419. However, looking a little deeper at this reveals that banks over $10 billion in total deposits actually closed 87 branches in that time frame, and banks over 10 billion, banks below 10 billion in total deposits opened a net two branches. So the smaller banks are basically breaking even. The larger banks are closing branches at a pretty quick pace, actually. In the last 5 years, Texas branches are down 434. The 10 largest banks account for 86% of that total. There are 237 state chartered banks and 24 thrifts chartered. by the two agencies. They control $258 billion and $23 billion total assets, respectively, and employ 44,000 Texans. Though the number of charters is reduced, the total assets has remained about the same. Though I will add, though, that there's been four public announcements of mergers that are in the pipeline right now that Texas Department of Banking is set to pick up. If those are all approved, we're going to pick up about $11 billion in total assets. So that's a big increase. There are also 69 out-of-state banks and thrifts operating in Texas, and that's an increase from 8 over last year. As far as capital, both for banks and thrifts, our capital rates at 10.6, leverage ratio and 11.6 for thrifts is above the national average of 9.7%. As far as earnings, profitability for banks and thrifts is very good on average, and key performance metrics for ROA, ROE, net interest margin, net charge-offs, and percent of unprofitable banks is well above the national average. As far as problem banks, I'm not going to go into that a lot, but it's very reasonable. There's 11 on the Texas banking side and two thrifts. Asset quality metrics all look very good. As far as positives, for the banking system, there's a strong Texas economy. Recent tax reform is considered by all the bankers as very positive news. Recent reg relief that was passed in May is starting to affect some of the banks. And then also changes to leadership at the federal agencies is generally viewed by the bankers as positive. Supervisory concerns continue to be cybersecurity is ever-present. Efforts to resolve lingering oil and gas and ag problems. Concentrations in commercial real estate, oil and gas and ag. Interest rate risk, non-core funding and liquidity, and then management succession. And then, of course, one thing that I also do in my duties is I try and follow, what could be the issue that causes the next economic downturn. And so I read a lot of articles on those things. And some of the things that are coming up more and more as far as what could cause the next economic recession that might also affect our banks or high levels of corporate and consumer debt. You think about the student loans that are out there, credit cards, auto paper, that could be an issue. The failure of one or more shadow banking firms, and if you're wondering what a shadow banking firm is, that's basically any non-bank that's not regulated. Large cybersecurity event, tariff wars with other countries, and then, of course, the federal budget deficit. So with that, I will – any questions?
Could you make an example? I mean, you gave a definition of shadow banking. An example for
me. Not broken Goldman Sachs.
Yeah. It would be the hedge funds, Google, Facebook, any of those have – private equity firms, anyone that uses anything other than a deposit account to fund their operations. And I'm not saying anything will happen, but if a major event did happen where a lot of consumers lost money or a lot of investors lost their money, there can be an issue there.
I had one question about the de novo statistics you gave. I can't remember how many you said were returned. I think it was either two or three.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, what is returned? Is that essentially a suspended? Is it a denial? It's not an approved. What is a returned?
I can tell you that most of the time for us at the Department of Banking, when that happens, there's something wrong with the application that we've gone to the entity and said, hey, look, you need to improve your application. If it comes through like this, we're going to have to not approve it. So do you want to rescind it? And most of the time they'll say, yeah, we want it back.
But you had withdrawn statistics also.
Yeah, withdrawn.
It's not a withdrawn. It's a,
let's see, what
a
was
separate
the other
category, which is the only reason why it caught my eye.
Yeah, let's see. Banking. Let me get to my banking area. Four were approved, two were returned, and three were withdrawn. So returned, I guess, would be a return for additional work on their application. That would be my
guess. So it's pending, so to speak.
Yeah, pending, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that they won't refile. They probably just need work on their app.
So I don't know who can answer this question, but Fed funds rates have been low for so long that I'm not sure I quite understand what the economic effect of Fed funds rates increases have on depository institutions. I mean, does it help with interest margins? Does it cause cost of funds to be higher? I just don't understand it. So.
Generally speaking, it's positive for the banks, but it also depends on where you are. It could be considered a negative, but those are where you are on the liquidity spectrum. If you have a lot of liquidity, you want that number to be high. If you're a borrower of that money, you know, it's. But generally speaking, it's viewed as a very positive event.
Just comment on the student loans. I listen to a radio program it's a call-in program about finances, et cetera, and I'm always overwhelmed by how many of those call-ins are associated with student loans and the amount of money that they're in debt and they're, you know, 27 years old or whatever. It seems like student loans are thrown onto people. Is there any talk beyond you just mentioning it about getting control? I mean, it sounds like kind of like the housing market a few years ago. We're throwing mortgage loans onto people and say, yeah, you qualify for anything.
Yeah, well, I mean, keep in mind that a lot of this doesn't go through the Texas banking system. They may end up buying a mortgage security that's backed by student loans, but they're typically not the originator of those student loans. So it's not going, most of it's not going through our banking system that we supervise. So, But I share your concerns. So a lot of people talk about the change in dynamics where when I graduated from college and the first thing we thought of was getting married, starting a family, buying a house. Well, all of that's being delayed by this generation that's coming out because they have so much student debt. So it's changing the whole dynamics of when people buy a home, when they start a family even. Because they have so much student debt right now.
So a mortgage lender would most likely look at that student debt in their consideration whether they'd loan the money or not, correct?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. It's a debt account.
Yeah. It does concern me.
Yeah.
Now there's a lot of discussion about it at the federal level. The CFPB, now the Bureau of Consumer Protection, they're looking into those activities where people maybe don't disclose properly. It's been very easy for anybody to get a loan. And, you know, that was kind of the American way, but there's been a lot of negative discussion about it and a lot of talks in Congress, but nothing other than talk. I don't think there's been anything that's been passed.
Okay, thank you, Kurt.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you to the agencies and everybody who participates in preparing this report, which is really thorough and gives us a lot of very good information. So on the Department of Banking side, Gordon, thank you for your information. Wendy, thanks, as always, for your participation and savings and mortgage lending. Thank you, Teresa, and thank you, Stephanie, for y'all's contributions to this report. It gives a variety of different stakeholders and consumers and interested parties information that would normally take so many different sources into a single report, which is very useful. Moving on to agenda item number 7, discussion of and possible vote to take action on the accomplishment reports for fiscal year 2018 for the commissioners of the Texas Department of Banking, Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending, and the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner. Would the agencies like to discuss or highlight these?
Yes. Hold on, I just lost my place. Okay, our starts on page 19. And so just to make sure everybody's on the same page, this was our priorities for 2018. Our priorities for 2018 and where we... What we accomplished or didn't accomplish during that period. A lot of information here. and I don't think it'd be good to go over everything, but I hit some highlights that I think are very important, and obviously, as usual, ask questions. For instance, if you go to page 20 for us, one was to complete the sunset process. And so I think we can say that all of us did that to varying degrees of success, but I think generally speaking, it was a good process to go through, but it took a long time to do it. On item Roman numeral 2, down to the bottom of 20, examination activity and enforcement actions, I'd like to say that a recap of these measures and 9 key measures, the department completed all of those, and it's in the packet that we'll talk about later on. I think a very important piece of this for all agencies would be the activity that we have at the national level, and obviously, I keep saying Texas is not an island. We have to interact with the other states and at the national level. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing our job. And so all of our folks are very active in that, and all the things that we do, not all of them, but the major ones are listed here. The on page 22, I want to point out that our agency is considered one of the leaders in cybersecurity, and we continue to be very involved in things having to do with cybersecurity as far as education, activity, whatever. And I'll remind y'all that our agency was a lead agency when Equifax came up, that we did an examination in conjunction with 7 other states, but our agency was in the lead, and our federal counterparts did very little in that. Again, if anybody has anything specifically they want to bring up, on page 28, strive to obtain full staffing. Then we'll talk about it a little bit later in more detail, but our goal was not to exceed 8% in non-retirement turnover. And I think it was 10.75 was the actual number, so we didn't do that. The examiner turnover, financial examiner turnover, was right at 8%. And there'll be a little more detail later on in the package that we'll talk about some numbers. Cybersecurity, as far as how our department deals with it internally, we completed our cybersecurity training for all department employees, and it seems like that's a constant activity that we have to go through to keep everybody up to speed on what to do and what not to do. And kind of lastly, on page 30, again, this is a lot of information that we present to y'all, and I think it's our report card, if I didn't say that, so it's very important that y'all look at it and challenge us if we need to be challenged. I will say that y'all have heard that we have to be accredited by CSBS every 5 years. The process started, actually completed, we had an exit meeting, so they've been working on us for probably 2 months. But we had our exit. They came in on site on Monday, and we had an exit meeting on Wednesday, where they go over just a litany of things that we do or don't do. And it's preliminary, and I couldn't tell you what the final score was, but it's going to be very high. So I was very pleased of that. If you will, it's a peer review. We had former commissioners and retired banking department officials from other states that So when you have a peer telling you that you're doing a good job, that means a lot to us. And we'll get the final report probably, I think they said, 6 weeks. So, questions? A lot of information. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Charles. Carolyn?
Yes. Savings and mortgage lending begins on page 31. And I'm going to make general comments under each grouping, and then certainly if you all want me to address anything more specifically or have questions, I'll be glad to. Under legislative items, we report to you our activity during interim session as well as during the sunset review process. Under regulatory items, we are updating you on the regulatory work that we did on both thrift and mortgage with regard to exams and supervision, as well as with regard to complaints. Our relationship and communication with federal agencies, regulatory agencies, and industry outreach and communications. During the course of the year, we served on various boards and committees and took opportunities for outreach and education, such as through industry trade associations, our own events, Thrift Industry Day and Mortgage Seminar, and my commissioner outreach meetings at each state savings bank. During the course of fiscal year 18, we began a new communication initiative for the state savings banks, that being a monthly emerging issues call in which we discuss with the CEOs and presidents and their senior team issues that we see emerging in the industry or that they see and want our input on. Within the agency itself, our turnover for the year was 7.5%, and we made critical updates to the network and staff computers and replaced technological equipment as needed. Be glad to address anything else if you would like me to.
Thank you, Caroline.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My report begins on page 37. And similar to the other, we have some similar issues to the other two agencies. Sunset review was obviously a fairly significant event in the last year. I kind of look at this whole report as sort of the year in review, and that was certainly one of the major items that we were undertaking during the year. At the bottom of page 37 and up on to 38 are issues related to our regulatory compliance. Obviously, that's one of the primary source of our mission. We'll have some of this detail that'll be covered in the regular reports later on, but we're looking at trying to maintain an acceptable level of compliance rate of 85% for our institutions, and we were at 85.57%, so we were within that tolerance. An item that's not mentioned there, but certainly showed growth amongst our organization in the area of examination. We served. We've brought our staff through a lot of experience over the years. We are now serving as a examiner in charge on some fairly complex multi-state examinations, and so that's an attainment that was in the last year. If you move ahead to page 40, there's information about TIFI. We just sort of discussed some of that information. I also wanted to highlight at the top of 41 some of the action in financial literacy, financial education. The team's been pretty active in meeting goals and in conducting presentations and delivering individual financial education in some of those target markets that we were concerned about. And on page 42, item 5.1, the performance targets, those are again listed later in the book, but we were able to meet 7 of the 9 key performance targets, which is what our objective was for the year. Similarly, on human resources, we've been trying to manage the turnover. With the low unemployment, we're seeing some of the effects of that. Again, we'll have more detail later on, but I think similar, we've seen less emphasis or less issues in the financial examiner series than we've seen maybe in some of the administrative areas. But overall, I think given the conditions, we've managed that as well as we could. And then lastly, I wanted to mention on page 44, information technology. We've been reporting to you. We were able to assimilate one of the last remaining items that was not within our platform and integrate that functionality throughout the last year. We were also able to implement two-factor authentication on some of our on our platform, and then we've been reporting to you on some of the security items that we had from a review that was 2 years ago, and the long roadmap of items that we've been working on, and all the midterm recommendations for fiscal year 18 were also implemented. And so I'm happy to answer any questions, but that would be my report.
Thank you. Well, I guess I was so exuberant about our financial condition report that Kurt presented that I neglected to take a vote on that. So if we might just step back for a moment and complete our business there. Do I hear a motion to approve the report on the financial condition of the state banking system?
Exuberantly.
Second.
Okay, thank you. Motion by Vince and second by Philip. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes. My apologies.
Madam Chair, just an observation. If each of the three agencies are having difficulties with staffing and the job market is obviously very hot, to attract this talent pool, is there some point in time we need to readjust our focus on the salaries and benefits that we're offering to make it a competitive office going forward?
That is a constant challenge for all three agencies, and we have that conversation on a regular basis. I talk to the three commissioners about that all the time as far as what do we need to do, the attempts of having some parity with federal, because it hits us not only from the staffing and the hiring, but on the turnover issue. So I open that up to the three.
And just looking at it from an industry perspective, we would welcome, you know, the stability and being able to have the staff
absolutely
consistently in our operations. But I think we all have recognized that there's excess in some of our funding, too. You know, we're making these decisions to liquidate some of these funds. Could we not use that to attract more staff?
Well, as an example, and I think we adjusted our numbers and gave what I'd call base increases in our 2019 budget. So we feel like we've already done that. We've got to play it out for this year. I'm going to speculate that. And I'll find out for sure, but I think our turnover rate in our agency is probably lower than some of our counterparts at the federal level. So, but seriously, we did an analysis before we presented our budget to you all compared to the FDIC and the ones where the position levels that we lag behind, we made an adjustment. And so, I think we. I won't. You know, our people never say they get paid too much, but I think we've done a pretty good job of that this time, and we'll be looking at it again next time.
And we see it from an industry perspective in our stores. You know, to retain some of our store employees, they can go across the street and make $5 more. Yeah. You know, a pay period. I mean, it's insignificant overall, but we're having a hard time as well. So, if we can increase the salaries for our state employees, that would be something I would welcome.
Salaries were incentives.
Correct.
And I know in the past that, and you may have just said this, that you try to be 10% lower than federal. No?
No, we're shooting for 95%. That's the FDIC.
So why not 100%?
No. No. You know, I'll have to say, you know, why is that? We did a step up. When I became commissioner, We increased that, and we've been increasing it basically every year to get to where but we didn't do it all at once. Now, one thing that I don't believe we can compete with, and I think I mentioned it at the last budget session, is that the FDIC, for instance, has a locale adjustment. And in my, I'm going to be off a little bit, but if you're in Dallas, your adjustment is like 15%. So on top of your base, you get 15%. In Houston, I think it's like 8%. In Austin, it's 3%. 3%. In Lubbock, it's like...
Minus 5?
Pretty close. And being a small agency, a couple of years ago, I found out no other Texas agency has a locale adjustment. The Texas Department of Public Safety has a I guess you call it a risk adjustment. If you're on the border, you get paid more than you are if you're in Texarkana. But I think that's something we're going to have to fight all the time. I believe, and based on our recent survey, that our employees, they'd like more, but they feel pretty good. The worst thing we have to fight now is travel. And we're trying to do our best we can to try to eliminate or mitigate the travel issue.
Point of clarification, that Texarkana is the border as well. but I think that the pay is one thing, but I think the career path and stability is also extremely important, and we can't forget about that. So.
Any other comments on accomplishments? Okay, do I hear a motion to approve the accomplishment reports for fiscal year 2018 for the commissioners of the Texas Department of Banking, Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending, and the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner?
So moved.
Second. And that would be? Go ahead and get extra and your second. Okay, for the record. Thank you. Moving on to agenda item 8, discussion of legislative initiatives for the Texas Department of Banking, Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending, and the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner, which that is found in your books on page 45. I'll start.
Okay, so on page 45, these are our areas that we're considering legislation, and let me just say that these have, when one legislative session is over, we start building ideas predicated on what's going on, about where we are, what we should present. These items that we've got listed here have not been, some of them have not been discussed with the stakeholders. We have gone through these internally. The list was much longer. We struck some things, we've added some things. So, for instance, the top one we have there is that we want to include the investigative cost in our enforcement cases. Right now, we don't think it's real clear that
we don't think it's real clear that we have the ability to recover those costs. And our federal counterparts have that. So, That's an example. Many other things on there. Bank of Trust, you got the listing there. Then we have perpetual care cemeteries and the prepaid funeral contract sellers. And then DOB in general, as a last component, DOB in general, you know, I think for probably 20 years, we've had this requirement on financial literacy, and it's hard to fulfill what it says we need to do, and so we're going to try to seek a little bit of refinement in that, but it's something we have to investigate. So if you have any specific questions, I'll be glad to go into it, or have bring Catherine Ryer up here and get her to explain things. A lot of these come from the industries, too, and a few of them what I call cleanup.
Thank you. Carolyn?
For savings and mortgage lending, the first two were recommended in the Sunset report, and I've followed up and talked to Sunset staff about those, and they'll be in the Sunset bill that Sunset staff drafts. The last one is temporary authority for licensing that has to do with the mortgage industry. On the federal level, there's been a law enacted that provides for temporary authority for individual loan originators to operate without a state license for 120 days. There's a whole lot of criteria to that. But this would be in two situations, someone moving from a depository to a non-depository, or someone who's licensed in another state operating in Texas for 120 days before obtaining a Texas license. And again, like I said, there's some defining criteria to that. But Texas law requires you to be licensed to originate. So we anticipate recommending that Texas enact similar to the federal, so that we're aligned with the federal We've talked to stakeholders. They are in agreement with wanting this to be clarified in statute. And so that's where that comes. That's what that is. So I'd be glad to answer any questions about any of these.
Thank you. Leslie?
If I could, I'd like to call on Matt Lance to come forward and Matt will walk through just a very high-level brief overview of what's presented in the background.
Good morning. Matt Nance, Deputy General Counsel, Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner. I'll be discussing the legislative issues on pages 47 and 48 of the materials. And the first set of recommendations, these first six bullet points on page 47, are sunset issues. Of course, we'll be very closely following the sunset bill. But these items are issues that are recommendations from the Sunset Commission that we had originally pointed out in our self-evaluation report. They mostly relate to operations and enforcement activities. I just wanted to highlight the last one, or kind of the last two, have to do with procedures for appealing contested case decisions. There are some different provisions in different parts of the finance code that talk about appealing contested case decisions to either the Finance Commission or to a district court in Travis County. And really, the kind of consistent practice under the Texas Administrative Procedure Act is that those get appealed to Travis County District Court. The Finance Commission is more of a policymaking body and has rarely heard those kinds of appeals, so we just wanted to see some more consistency there. And the Sunset Commission agreed with that and included that recommendation. So those are items that that we raised and that Sunset agreed with. Kind of the next set of issues on page 48 has to do with online lending and fintech. And these were issues we had pointed out in our self-evaluation report. There was some talk of Sunset adopting some of those, but they ultimately decided
Matt,
to...
Can we go back to the first bullet point?
Absolutely.
So when it becomes, when it's given to the complainant, does it then becomes a public document and anybody can see it? Would that be the statutory concept?
The general rule we're dealing with these confidentiality provisions is that information is generally public unless a statute specifies that it's confidential. And I don't know that we've discussed, like, whether it becomes public information at that point.
Well, if you give it to a complainant.
Yeah, I suspect that, yeah, the information would become public information, that kind of summary of the complaint. Right, would become public information when that kind of basic investigation summary is provided back to the complainant, yeah.
So generally, making information public is a good idea, but it seems to me that sometimes there are benefits to keeping things confidential. So it's sort of hard just with this bullet point to understand what the nuances are around that. So I'd appreciate some thinking about what our position would be on confidentiality versus not confidentiality.
Sure. I think we understand there's, the legislature has decided to generally keep exam and investigation information confidential, but sometimes those investigations result in instructions to provide, refunds and relief to consumers. And without, going into the ins and outs of the financial operation of the business and kind of disclosing sensitive information, I think the idea here was to kind of summarize the actions that were taken that came out of it. If there was relief provided to consumers as a result of the investigation, to provide some sort of summary of that of those actions that were taken. So I think that's kind of the general idea behind that bullet point, if that makes sense.
It does, but it just seems to me, like I said, it seems to me that there are nuances here.
Sure.
And those nuances aren't captured by this bullet point, and so I'd sort of like to make sure we understand what we're doing when we do this.
Okay. Any other questions about the kind of the six bullet points on the first page that were issues we had raised that became Sunset recommendations? Okay. Online lending and fintech is a rapidly evolving area. Like I was saying, there was some talk that the Sunset Commission might incorporate some of that into their recommendations. They wound up not doing that. But there was a House Investments and Financial Services Committee report that in 2017 that talked about amending Texas consumer lending laws to specify they apply to online lenders. So we've been, you know, thinking about what are some ways that that could happen. And so these two first bullet points on page 48, you know, list possibly specifying that the finance code applies to loans made to Texas residents and, you know, amending a section about loans by mail to specify it also applies to online loans. But that's an issue we're watching closely, even though that may not be part of the Sunset process. There might be other possible legislation on that. And then the other points on page 48 were more technical issues we had identified in our strategic plan. Some of these came up in some legislation in 2015 that wound up not passing the Texas legislature, but like the second bullet point about studies the agency conducts and kind of specifying that those study requirements apply to consumer lending, the information that our agency has access to. Another item was that fourth bullet point about registration deadlines, where two of our registration categories, the tax refund anticipation loan providers and crafted precious metal dealers, the statute is phrased in a way that requires a registrant to register before December 31st of the year before they're going to engage in business. And a business might not know that by that time. So anyway, that is just kind of a high-level summary of a few of the points I wanted to highlight. I'm happy to answer any questions about that. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Moving on to agenda item number 9, discussion of management actions from the Sunset Report. Charles?
Okay. So on the legislative Sunset side, we had obviously things that will be in a bill, like the chair mentioned earlier, but there are also some recommendations in there that they told us to do certain things. So I'm going to go over those just briefly. From the report on item 2.2, it said direct the Finance Commission to evaluate and update the agency's key performance measures. So we just went over our 2018. So we're going to do some modification in 2019. As an example, we're going to try to provide you with more historical information so when you you can kind of track where we are and where we have been. So that's, in my opinion, is probably a good recommendation. I think they talked to us about making the complaint process a little bit more similar, and we've already started working on that. But that's on 2.2. On 2.3, it says direct the Finance Commission to develop a budget policy that fosters more straightforward budgeting and fee setting. Now, I think this is primarily directed toward the issue of forgiving or reductions in the assessments toward the end of the year. Just, we talked about that a little bit earlier. And we have come up with, three agencies have come up with a policy. We'll be submitting that to Stacy, Molly, and Paul for the first review. I think we'll do that next week. And then the goal is to have this policy presented to the Finance Commission in the December meeting. 2.4, direct the Finance Commission to update its fund balance policy to limit growth. And again, we in the audit committee, we went over our fund balance, how many months we had, and they told us to submit some of this information to the governor, lieutenant governor, and the speaker, and to the advisory committee. That's one example of what we have to do. So obviously we'll do that, and then we'll be working on the fund balance policy to see if we can fine tune that to some degree. I'll just say that I don't forget now exactly when we started our policy, but we revised it, and I think we basically said let it work, and so that's probably what we're going to do. 2.5, direct the Finance Commission to develop standard policies regarding tracking and reporting of travel expenditures. In recent history, there was a agency that got into trouble for traveling, maybe to seminars or trade group meetings and things like that, because they weren't using very good judgment. So now we are suffering from that, and so we're going to give them more categories on travel for y'all to look at. For instance, you'll be able to see if we go to for the seminars and things like that, non-regulatory type travel, so more transparency. 2.6, direct the Finance Commission to minimize duplication of agency functions and promote more cost-efficient administration. That's what we talked about in the audit committee about, and that's why we hired McConnell to assist us on doing that. And then probably the last thing is, the agencies are in the process of drafting a training manual for Finance Commission members. More detail and something that you, a hard copy or at least a copy you can refer back to if you have questions, and it should help in that regard.
Hopefully that won't be multi-volume. Things do change on a regular basis, so I think from the standpoint of the training manual, that will help the Finance Commission members. We are not government employees, and we're appointees, and it's hard for us to keep up with everything. So that recommendation in particular is something that I think will be beneficial to all of us. Any other comments on sunset? Okay. Agenda items 10, 11, 12, and 13 will move to executive session. So that will take us to agenda item B, which is Texas Department of Banking. And before we start there, Charles, I just wanted to make two comments. First, I wanted to congratulate Charles and on his most recent appointment to, is it FISOC or FSOC?
FSOC.
I keep getting it wrong, which stands for Financial Stability Oversight Council?
Yes.
Okay. So FSOC, which is a tremendous accomplishment. It requires a position that be a state banking regulator, and that was just really high profile for us, and just very excited about that and very proud of that accomplishment for you. And it's a two-year appointment, and congratulations on that. It speaks very well for the agencies and for Texas. Secondly, in an attempt for outreach, I try to attend as many different stakeholder and industry seminars and conventions as possible to interact one-on-one with people, hear their concerns and their feedback, and understand what's going on in their industry so that we can do our job better here sitting up here. And I just recently attended the Independent Bankers Association's convention, and I just wanted to say that at that convention there was a regulatory panel of which Charles and Caroline both spoke. The commentary that I received, in particular, Charles, from so many bankers that I met for the first time and spoke to, as well as a variety of other industry-related people, just tells me what an excellent job I think the departments are doing as far as representing, being well-respected, and being highly regarded regulators. And it's great to hear that feedback one-on-one, because it's easy to sit there and think everybody's doing a good job, but to hear from people that we're doing a good job is always very reassuring. So with that, We'll move on to page 51 in the agenda and Department of Banking.
Let me turn this off again.
Sorry, don't mean to echo.
That's okay. First off, I wanted to give you all some bad news. We just heard, actually I just found out this morning that J.W. Holt, who was our director in Lubbock, regional director in Lubbock, passed away yesterday unexpectedly. Some of you have met J.W. He was with the department about 20 years. He was somewhat a legend and in West Texas, so a very sad day. I want to mention generally one thing, and it was mentioned earlier, this fintech issue that we all talk about. At the national level, the OCC has come out actively to say that they will have a fintech charter, a non-bank bank charter, if you can figure that out. And so the state of New York has filed a lawsuit against the OCC. This is a repeat performance. CSBS and New York filed lawsuits about a year ago, maybe a little bit longer than that, and the court said the issue was not ripe yet, and now it is ripe. So CSBS is considering also filing a lawsuit. Basically, we're going to say number one is the OCC does not have the ability to charter such an entity. It's they just do not have the power to do it. That's our basic. But there'd be a lot of discussion about this. If you read American Banker, seem like every day there or Wall Street, seem like every day. There's an article in there about fintech, and so there'll be more discussion about that, I guess, later as things evolve. So back on page 51, we go through this every meeting. You will see now that our number of banks down to 236, and if you look at the period 8/31/17, we were at 240. So 240 down to 36. But if you also look at our volume, has gone up. And Kurt mentioned some prospective mergers, and it'll just drive our dollar volume up. But I'm still concerned and will be about the number declining. Most of those or community banks, generally speaking, if a community loses a bank, it creates a problem. In these cases, they're merging, but we do have a situation where a bank exists, it merges into a larger bank, and then over a period of time, that what used to be a bank basically turns into an ATM in some cases. So we're monitoring that, but as far as our ability to meet our, because of the dollar volume, we're okay. Down at the dollar, at the bottom, again, we talk about 3, 4, and 5 rated banks that we call problem banks. We have 11 of those, and that number continues to just kind of bounce around at the bottom. On page 52, we are now down to 25 enforcement actions. Down at the bottom of the page, it gives our compliance with examination priorities, and for 2018, we exceeded those. The ones that were exceptions, we had nine banks. I believe two of those belong to the department, and the rest of them, or seven, belong to the FDIC. We're talking about where they stand. They say that they couldn't get to these banks because of staff reduction. So And that's, I guess that's been a trend. And we are moving in 2019. We're moving our goal. Our goal is to be within 90%, and we're moving that number to 95. So we're increasing that goal. Division highlights. I want to mention. Stacy mentioned my appointment to FSOC. I want to. I've now had two meetings. The second meeting was Tuesday of this week. The members are basically all the heads of the financial agencies that have to do with financial, like the SEC and folks like that are there. We have five non-voters. I'm one of those non-voters. So we get to talk, but we don't get to vote. But so Tuesday, as an example, and you may have read this, Prudential, the insurance agency, had been listed as being a company that could impact the economic financial ability of our country negatively just because of its size. I think that was given about 3 years ago, and at this meeting it was voted to remove them. So they got relieved of having to be supervised by the Federal Reserve. So I don't vote, but the chairman, Secretary Mnuchin, asked me first what my opinion was. So I get to say what my opinion is, and usually I have one. So another thing, cybersecurity. I want to mention this. I think this is very important. When we do our banker survey, the main concern by our bankers is cybersecurity. And as you all know, I've been trying to get everybody to improve on their cybersecurity. So we decided to maybe put our money where our mouth is. We have 10 cybersecurity experts that go around and to our banks and third-party service companies and work specifically on cybersecurity. But we tell our bankers that they need to have the CEO of a bank, for instance, needs to know a little bit about cybersecurity. And our financial examiners, and if by count, we have about 103 financial examiners. We are going to send every one of those, and that includes me and Kurt and others, and Dan and others. We're going to send them to a special cybersecurity school, and that is in conjunction with something that CSBS is providing. And so I hope by the end of 2019, everybody that has a badge, a financial examiner, including our special audits group, will have gone through this. So that should help our agencies, our licensees and our banks. When these people go in there, they'll be able to converse better with the CEO of the entity and with their experts that are in cybersecurity, and I think that'll go a long way to helping Texas. This is being done nationwide, and I mentioned the accreditation, CSBS accreditation, a little bit earlier. More detail about the schools and everything that our people participate in. If I could refer you to page 55 and 56. Which is the corporate division activity reports. Dan Frazier's back there. Dan reports that the flurry is kind of flattened a little bit under the activity charter conversion. Plains Capital bought Bank of River Oaks, so by number that means we're down. By volume or by size, it's a state bank buying a state bank, so it doesn't do anything about size. First State Bank Louise completed its acquisition of First National Bank Woodsboro. So the number doesn't go up, but our volume goes up. Real Bank McAllen completed its acquisition of a state bank. And so that's, again, minus one, but nothing on volume. First State Mesquite merged into American National Bank of Texas and Terrell, so both volume and numbers go down there. Citizens Bank Kilgore acquired Gladewater National, so doesn't affect the number, but our volume goes up. And then Alliance Bank Houston completed its acquisition of Post Oak Bank in NA in Houston. So that is volume up. So during this period, we lost three banks. Okay? So I just want y'all to keep y'all updated on the volume. And then I think we have had, we talked about de novos. Our last bank charter was in 2017, Bank of Austin here in Austin. We have had no de novo applications. Kurt, I think you mentioned there have been 18 applications nationwide. I believe that's what you, okay. We have not had any. For instance, North Carolina has had five. And I wonder, well, why North Carolina, why not Texas? Because of all the activity that we're aware of. We have had, I think, two calls from lawyers representing groups talking about coming in and talk to us about an application, so a de novo application. So hopefully that will pick up again. On page 57, special audit activity, top of the page, if you'll notice, MSBs or physical ending 17, we had 156. Fourth quarter 18, we're up to 161. So there's been a little activity in that area for money service businesses, either startups or companies that we found out need a license from us. From down at the bottom, it talks about the 1s, 2, and 3 rated banks and the 4 and 5 rated banks. You will see how that activity has occurred. So we have, and Russell's not here, we have 13 in the 4 and 5 rated area number now. page 58, down in, just kind of recap, special audits met or exceeded all of its performance measures for fiscal year 18. Division activity. I want to point out that on September 21 and 22, Director Reese and Examiner Vallis met with representatives from the Department of Homeland Security in Irving to discuss ongoing criminal activity investigation against one of our licensed MSBs. So we continue to work with law enforcement, and in this case, a federal agency. Page 59, I just want to mention, so last year, at the end of this year, all of our area, we had 25 resignations. I mentioned the turnover rate a little bit earlier. We had 19 in 2017, so resignations are up. But resignations include retirements, and so six of those are in the retirement area, and we had four retire last year. And then on the right-hand side on the pie chart, financial examiners only, we had 15 resignations in 18, and we had 12 in 17. So I gather from that, just a general statement that a lot of the most of the resignations increase have been in the administrative area. 61, we met all the key performance measures. Let's see, we go to the output measures, and on page 65, you'll see all of those. Again, this is 2018. On the non-key measures on page 67, we met or exceeded the non-key measure, all of them with the exception of the complaints. On 1.3.1, which is on page 68, you know, we come up with how many complaints we think we'll receive. In this case, we didn't receive as many complaints as we projected, so I guess that's a good thing. Beginning on page 69, detail on the complaints. It's I would say basically it's kind of normal type activity. On page 76, we talk about the website activity and the hits that we get, and then on page on the department's website, and then on page 77. We talk about how many people review our webcast of the Finance Commission, and we have an astounding amount of people that review that. So we'll see what happens on this one. And that is all of the general report. Ready to go? You want to?
Quick question before you move to the legal update. On page 69, on the chart, the first chart on the jurisdictional complaints, I'm confused. So help me understand the Texas State Charter Bank 310 number.
Okay, well, this is a category.
Because I understand the chart, but what's the 310 number representing? Because the bank counts at 234.
No, that's the number of complaints.
Number of complaints. Oh, number of complaints. Thank you. I'm looking at it. Okay, yeah, so that's total number of complaints. Thank you. Sorry for misunderstanding that.
So we have complaints, and then we also have inquiries, because we try to make sure that an inquiry doesn't count as a complaint. Any questions?
Thank you.
I have a question. You mentioned that in certain branches that were closed, that in certain areas we end up with an ATM. Do we have any information on smaller communities or perhaps rural communities that ended up with not having a single branch? Do we have any information on that as a result of consolidation or mergers or?
There is some detail on that. A lot of it ended up though where they just closed their branch, and these are the bigger banks, and usually, I'm answering your question in a roundabout way, usually somebody picked up that branch. They bought the building and then they branched into it, but there have been, and most of it was in West Texas, but there have been quite a few that they just closed it, and that was the end of it. I think we can get that data, but it'll do a little bit of work. I'll see if I can come up with that. Okay, Catherine, you want to come up and give the legal report?
Good morning, members. Catherine Ryer, General Counsel, Texas Department of Banking. And in the interest of time, I'm just going to mention a couple of items on the legal memo update. But, of course, if you have questions about any of the items, I'm happy to answer those. One item that I did want to bring to your attention is on page 78. This is in the matter of Billy F. Peel. This is a local funeral home in Austin. This gentleman was previously licensed with us to sell prepaid funeral contract merchandise. He lost his license in 2006. Unfortunately, late August, or I guess mid-August, we found out that Mr. Peel had continued to sell prepaid funeral merchandise without a license. So we issued an order to seize records. Our review of those records showed about 247 people that have purchased prepaid funeral merchandise. We seized information about his bank accounts and the ledgers for the funds that he had accepted from these people. It looks like there's about probably $550,000 in merchandise that where the funds were accepted, they were not deposited into trust, And so that money is owed to individuals. It is not a good situation. We had a hearing scheduled for October 11th. We, since seizing the records, we did a media alert. We've had some local media attention on this. We've had some customers step forward and tell us about additional merchandise that has been purchased that did not appear in the ledgers. So we've been talking with those customers, receiving their information, compiling it with what we got from the funeral home, and trying to get a more accurate picture of what the exposure is. So we've postponed that hearing in order to get that more accurate picture. We currently have a hearing set for November 7th. In the meantime, we're talking with Mr. Peel, who has since met with us, told us that he is intending to make good on these contracts, on these benefits that were promised. He has since also retained an attorney. We've been talking with that attorney about how to fund the refunds. So it's a very unfortunate situation, but I did want to let you know about it, especially since there has been some media attention.
So, Catherine, why isn't there a criminal referral somewhere in here?
There very well may be a criminal referral. Our first goal is to get the money back to the customers if possible. So we have been talking. We've had an initial conversation with the Attorney General's office on this, and either through them, through their law enforcement contacts, or through our own law enforcement contacts, absolutely it is a possibility.
Wouldn't that be a Travis County District Attorney's issue AG's office?
It could be. As I said, our main goal at this point is to understand what is the exposure and try to get the funds back to the customers. Our experience with law enforcement is that the law enforcement process takes longer. So, like I said, this is our immediate focus is getting the money back to the people it's owed to.
And given that, my question that I held earlier pertained to this. So do you anticipate any claims against the prepaid funeral fund as a result of this?
We understand that there are a few of these that may be insurance funded, and so it is possible that a few of these claims may have some coverage, but the large majority probably will not, because they were unauthorized. They were sold without a license.
Unlicensed activity.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
So the only other item that I wanted to mention to you in the legal memo is, this is on page 79 of your packet, and this is that we have issued a We've issued an order against an entity called Southwest Group. This is another unlicensed money service business, and we have a hearing scheduled against them on January 17th. And I'm sorry, I will mention one more thing, and that is we had a there's an item there stating that there was a confidential prohibition matter pending before an administrative law judge that we successfully went to mediation, and that matter has been resolved, and that order is posted on our website.
And I believe y'all received
Thank you. We do have some rules. Okay, I'll have Chris, can you come up?
No. Takes us to agenda item 7, I assume is what you're referring to.
Yeah.
Discussion of and possible vote to take action on the proposal and publication for comment of amendment to 7 TAC Part 1, Chapter 5, Section 5.101 concerning employee training and education assistance programs, which is page 91.
Good morning, members. My name is Chris Bell, Assistant General Counsel, Texas Department of Banking. Thank you for allowing me to be here this morning. The proposed amendment to 5101 concerns subsection E, When this commission originally adopted 5.101 in 2014, it was to implement Section 656.048 of the Texas Government Code. Subsection E required the finance agencies to develop and maintain policies for administering the employee training and education programs for the respective finance agencies. Those policies have since been developed and continue to be maintained by the finance agencies. So we recommend amending the rule to recognize the progress made by the finance agencies. I'm glad to answer any questions.
So the actual rules on page 93, is that?
That is correct, sir, the proposed amendment.
So this is just a nit, but, you know, when reading the rule, it would be nice to list those down the below where it says no change. It's sort of hard to get the context of the rule when you don't have the language there. So just in the future when you put that, you know, if you'd sort of add a little bit, I don't know what the protocol is, but it was a little confusing to me when I
completely understand, sir. The format of the proposed amendment is actually required by the Texas Register, but as we do this in the future, we can certainly try to address that.
Well, I think the Texas Register, that's sort of a minimum standard, right?
So my understanding and my experience with them is they're very particular about how things are published.
We'll look into it.
We certainly will.
Yeah, we can do a
preamble solution.
Yeah.
Or a mock-up or something. Yeah. Okay.
But do a. Okay. Well, seeing no other questions, then I move that the commission publish for comment the proposed amendments to 7TAC Section 5101 in the Texas Register.
Do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment of amendment to 7TAC 1, Part 1, Chapter 5, Section 5.101 concerning employee training and education assistance programs?
So moved.
So moved by Lori. Who was the second? Second by Paul. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes. Agenda item 8, discussion of impossible vote to take action on the proposal and publication for comment of amendment to 7TAC Part 2, Chapter 26, Section 26.11, concerning perpetual care cemetery complaints, which starts on page 94.
All right. So the proposed amendment to 2611, which is described on page 96 of the packet, essentially clarifies the existing departmental policy concerning when a perpetual care cemetery owner must provide the complaint notice on its website. The amendment is offered to prevent an incorrect and narrow reading of the rule as codified. I'll be glad to entertain any questions. Okay. Well, seeing none, I move that we publish for comment the proposed amendment to 7TAC 26.11 in the Texas Register.
Thank you. Do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment of amendment to 7TAC Part 2, Chapter 26, Section 26.11 concerning perpetual care cemetery complaints? So moved by Philip.
Second.
Second by Will. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it. The motion passes. Agenda item 9, discussion of impossible vote to take action on the proposal and publication for comment amendments to 7TAC Chapter 33, Sections 33.23 and 33.35 concerning money services businesses, permissible investments, and record retention related to money transmission transactions, respectively, starting on page 97.
The proposed amendment to Section 33.35, which is described on page 101 of the packet, corrects a statutory reference to a federal statute that's that has been updated in the past. The proposed amendment to 33.23 relates to permissible investments, and essentially 33.23 implements Section 151.309 of the Texas Finance Code, which requires a money transmission license holder to maintain specific assets known as permissible investments relative to their outstanding money transmission obligations. The statute enumerates certain types of permissible investments and also vests this commission with the authority to add to this list based upon a determination that the assets or investments being considered have a safety substantially equivalent to other permissible investments in a statute. The proposed amendment would have this commission exercise such authority to allow a money transmission license holder to count as permissible investments receivables owed to it by a bank as a result of an automated clearinghouse, debit, or credit-funded transmission with certain limitations. The proposed amendment stems from requests directly from license holders and members of the industry that they be allowed to count these receivables as permissible investments. In our investigation into this issue and consideration of these requests, the department confirmed that at least six states, including California and Washington, allow for these receivables to satisfy permissible investment requirements. We recommend that Texas follow suit by adopting the proposed amendment, which is modeled on the other states that allow these receivables to count as permissible investments. And I'll be glad to entertain any questions regarding this. Seeing no questions, then I recommend that that the amendment be published for comment in the Texas Register.
Do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment of amendments to 7 TAC Chapter 33, Sections 33.23 and 33.35 concerning money services businesses, permissible investments, and record retention related to money transmission transactions, respectively? So moved by Will. Okay, second. Second by Philip. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion passes. Thanks, Catherine. Thanks, Chris.
Madam Chair, if I could make a quick comment. As Chris mentioned, we have at least two other states that have adopted this, and so in our effort to harmonize what's required of money service businesses nationwide. So one state doesn't have one thing, one state doesn't have another. This is an example, and I expect other states are doing the same thing. Or I hope they are.
Okay, thank you. The time right now is 11:57. At this time, the Finance Commission will take a 10-minute break, and the time is 11:51 of the Government Code, and the time is 12:10 p.m. And we will start next with Agenda Item C, Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending. But before I turn it over to Caroline, I wanted to make a similar comment with respect to having just attended the TMBA conference in Dallas, which was also Mortgage Industry Day event. And I wanted to extend a thank you to all of the staff at Savings and Mortgage Lending who presented there. It was an excellent presentation. And also pass along the good comments that I received from a variety of people that I spoke to about the agency and its performance. And then I do want to apologize again. This is an annual event. For me, having missed Thrift Industry Day, I promise one day it will not conflict with my annual Telluride vacation, and I will go. But when it's Thrift Day and Telluride, Telluride always wins. So I'm so sorry I missed that one. And then Savings and Mortgage Lending starts on page 105.
Great. Thank you. I'll start with the Thrift Industry update. On Chart A, this reflects positive trends in the thrift industry. Capital is generally in good position, and overall the industry is healthy and doing well. Non-performing assets on Chart B, non-performing assets continue to be very low, and the profit margin has increased slightly in the second quarter. Chart C, long-term asset exposure, interest rate risk. There remain a small number of institutions that are outliers, and so they cause a slight increase in the chart. Same small number has been in the same situation for many years, and so we know who they are, and we have watched them manage their long-term asset exposure well. So there's nothing significant here for us as the regulator. Under Chart D for liquidity risk in the thrift industry is increasing, but it remains modest. Net non-core funding dependence increased in the second quarter, due to some growth and acquisitions, organic growth and acquisition growth, and it remains manageable. The loan-to-deposit ratio is elevated also due to growth and acquisitions. There are a few outliers driving this elevation. We're aware of what is causing that in those outliers, and we know what their exit strategies are should they have to exit some funding sources. On page 107, chart E, 92% of state savings banks are well rated. We have two formal enforcement actions. Under mergers and acquisitions, the TBK bank acquisitions that we've been reporting to you have closed September 8th. They acquired three institutions, all out-of-state institutions. On September 10th, we received an application from Spirit of Texas Savings SSB to acquire a national bank. That application is in process. And that is a national bank that's located in Texas, I suppose. Under other items, we're reporting to you information about outreach to the industry as well as to the attorneys who represent the industry. And also information about the recent Community Banking Research Conference, which I attended. Commission Member Will Lucas attended as the State Savings Bank representative, and certainly appreciate him being there. The 11th Annual Thrift Industry Day agenda is in the materials, and we do appreciate Commission Member McCauley and Commission Member Lucas attending Thrift Day. At Thrift Day, we had a panel with a couple of the State Savings Bank CEOs whose institutions were impacted by Hurricane Harvey to update the thrift industry on emergency closings, not only with regard to hurricanes, but to all the type of emergency closings that are in the statutes, and there's a general section as well. Along the same lines as hurricanes, we do have a State Savings Bank with a branch in Florida. So we did check in with that State Savings Bank and with our federal counterpart due to Hurricane Michael. Fortunately, there was no impact on that branch during Michael. And on a more local level, we've had no impact from the flooding in the Hill Country on the State Savings Banks. What we are monitoring is what's going to happen downstream if additional floodgates are open. The last I heard, there were four open and that there were four remaining. I have not heard. We've been here, so I have not heard if those have been open. But we are watching to see what happens if they are open, because downstream we could certainly have an impact on some State Savings Banks. So we'll be watching for that. Okay, I'm going to move on to page 109, although I'm happy to answer questions now about thrift if you'd like, or at the end, of course. But I'm going to move into the mortgage industry on page 109, and starting with licensing. The number of licensees are in the materials. I won't repeat those, as are the number of applications received and processed and the number of other filings and sponsorship requests. All of those have slightly increased since the same time last year. All of the licensees, if they want to continue originating residential mortgage loans, have to renew between November 1st and December 31st. And if they don't, then they are considered terminated, failed to renew, and they would have until the end of February 19 to apply for reinstatement. If we hit March 1 and they haven't either been renewed during renewal or reinstated during reinstatement, then if they want to originate mortgage loans in Texas, they need to start all over and apply and submit for a totally new application. We have included some historical information and year-end information about the mortgage industry under SML's jurisdiction. Both of these charts, the entity licensing and loan originator as of 8/31. The first chart is entities, giving historical information from 2011 forward. I do want to point out 34.7% of licensed entities have been licensed with the state for 3 years or less. And of those, 41.8% were licensed within the last year. With regard to the loan originator licensing history chart, over half of the Texas licensed individual originators have been licensed with Texas for 3 years or less. And of those, 46.6% have been licensed for the first time within the last year. with regard to mortgage examinations, the ratings chart comparing fiscal year end 18 to the last two fiscal years is on page 111. Those ratings are consistent with the last 2 years. And the ratings is 1 through 5. 1 is strong, 2 is satisfactory, 3 is less than satisfactory, 4 is deficient, and 5 is critically deficient. The top violations we've seen at exams over the course of the last fiscal year were social media and website issues and state-specific disclosure issues. Looking at complaints, the nature of complaints received in fiscal year 18, loan servicing was 69%, misleading practices 14%, and then we dropped to single digits. The disposition of mortgage complaints. For fiscal year 18, 50% were closed for insufficient evidence. So the issue fell under SML's jurisdiction. We did an investigation based on the information that we received from the consumer. We may have needed to follow up with the consumer and try to get more information that would help us to determine whether there truly was a valid complaint or not, and we did not receive enough information to make that determination, so we closed it for insufficient evidence. 30% were no jurisdiction, which means we opened it, we looked at it, it was not something under our jurisdiction, so we referred it to the correct regulator. And then negotiated resolutions in which we are able to get the two parties to reach an agreement without us having to issue an order was 13%, and the ones that we actually had to refer to enforcement for legal action was 5%. Other items on mortgage, we have information about Texas Mortgage Roundup and the 6th Annual Mortgage Industry Seminar that were our outreach to the industry between last Finance Commission member meeting and today. The agenda for the mortgage seminar is in the materials, and we do appreciate Chairman Linden attending mortgage seminar. Thank you. I want to mention something, a subject that's increasingly evolving in the mortgage industry that we have been following for some time, and just wanted to give you some information about it because you'll continue to hear us report on this. Technological advances in the mortgage process, really, and digital mortgage tools. You may recall that last session we tracked a bill that would allow electronic notaries or e-notaries to be used in Texas, and that bill passed. The rules relating to e-notaries are under the purview of the Secretary of State. The mortgage industry was very supportive and very involved in that bill. So e-closings are taking place in some parts of the country. We've heard of closings where the borrower is signing documents or e-signing documents standing in the new home that they are closing on. These innovations are driven partially by customer demand, particularly millennials and others who don't want to leave their house and drive to an office across town to sit and sign wet signatures on documents. It's also driven by a desire in the industry to shorten the time the process takes from application to closing and to have more efficient loan production. Some of the subjects that are being discussed in the industry relate to cybersecurity issues with a more electronic process, with whether all investors are ready to accept delivery of e-documents, or do they need to modernize their processes, and are they willing to and interested in doing so. They're also discussing the striking a balance between technology and human engagement in the loan application process, and how to be ready to offer multiple closing options, e-closings for some customers and traditional closings for others. In Texas, with the e-notaries, we've run into an obstacle with regard to many counties who lack the capacity to perform electronic notary or e-recordings of documents. So for SML in this discussion, we recognize that we need to be engaged so we can strategically plan for the time when it's necessary for us to modernize our policies and procedures, rules, and maybe even statutes to cover a changing and more electronic mortgage process. So towards that end, we've been in communication with the industry and will continue to do so. On the measures, starting on page 114. I want to mention two measures in particular, specifically, and then I'd be glad to address any others that you would like me to. The first one has to do with the number of states, percentage of states chartered savings banks receiving exams within the required time frame. And I mention this because our target was 100%, which is generally what we meet, and we hit 88%. That's due to that's because in each situation there was a pending regulatory application with another regulator. And I made the decision to defer these two start dates on the exams because doing so would be more reasonable and realistic for the institution and also would utilize our resources in a more prudent manner. I knew we'd miss our time frame, but this was the best route to go to defer. One deferral was 30 days and one was for 60 days. But. And then the other one I wanted to specifically address is the percent of assets in safe and sound institutions, because our target was 90%, we hit 60%. The bottom line is that there is not a systemic problem and that none of the issues were related to asset quality issues. We have been seeing more repeat findings than we normally do. And I can't tell you that there's a particular cohesive thread, but that's just the way it has been this past year. We found more repeats than usual. And so we are taking certain actions to be proactive to get those, help the institution get those corrected before the next exam happens. And I will say that the relevant state savings bank management teams are making great progress. And so we feel like they are they are doing some of the corrections. These are items that could be readily correctable during the normal course of operations and weren't. So we're pleased with what we see them doing in terms of making progress. And if there are any other measures you want me to talk about, I'd be glad to. Then, with regard to the agency itself, fiscal operations on page 118, our turnover, as I said earlier, was 7.5%. Of that one, that's four people. Of that one was a retirement. One was an examiner. So reasons were retirement, one was involuntary, two were voluntary. Of those, one went to another state agency, so it's not a regulatory agency, and one left for personal reasons. We have four positions posted that are in various stages of the hiring process, and those are listed in your book. General Counsel Garcia is conducting depositions for an upcoming hearing, so I'm going to give you his legal report. We've had no SOA contested cases before SOA since the last meeting. Under gift reporting, we paid for last January and April some cybersecurity training from the CSBS Education Foundation. And then in August, the board of CSBS decided to approve a grant for those trainings, so we received a refund. However, we're reporting that as a gift because at the end of the day, so to speak, we did not have to pay for that due to the grant. So, in litigation, the SML versus VPW case, this is an instance of unlicensed loan modification activity. We issued a cease and desist order and ordered restitution for consumers. Subsequently, we found that cease and desist order had been violated. And so we issued another cease and desist with the main, and again ordered restitution for another consumer because by that time there had been further harm. We have gone through the Attorney General's office to obtain a permanent injunction against this company because they have not stopped. And so that permanent injunction was granted September of this year. So we still have one other defendant in play, but it looks like this is looks like we're where we need to be or will be shortly. So. that's our report. I would be glad to answer questions about anything. Any questions?
Okay. The leader gets the fear of the question.
Moving on to agenda.
Exactly.
Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner on page 123.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So beginning on page 123, first we'll hear the examination report, and we'll see for our fiscal year end production. We had a goal of 4,200 examinations. We exceeded that goal and performed 4,503 examinations. You look at the chart, you can see the distribution of those examinations compared to the prior year, very similar, very normal activity, so we were pleased with that production. Page 124, you see the compliance levels of the respective industries, and as I mentioned previously in the accomplishment report, our overall goal was 85%. We obtained 85.6%. You'll see we have one area of concern right now under credit access businesses. We'll continue to be monitoring that, working on that issue, try to bring that compliance back up within normal ranges. On page 125, information about investigations completed for the fiscal year 2018, you'll see the performance of 77. That's down from the prior year. Some of that, the change is due to the fact that we don't have those credit card surcharge area of enforcement anymore, and so there were a number of investigations in the prior year that related to those. But it also follows a similar trend. You see from complaints process that those were also down this fiscal year. I think you've already heard one of the other agencies say that was a trend that they experienced as well. Some of the positive economic indicators may be varied on that, again, and the change of enforcement areas. But we continue to monitor those closely. You'll see normal detail on the breakout of complaint issues on page 126. On page 127, I will mention that this ratio that we track has the movement. We see motor vehicle sales finance had been in the fourth position at the last time I reported this to you. They have moved up to the third position. They're still our number one type of complaint that we resolve. That distribution is probably a little bit more normal. However, for fiscal year 18, I think normally we don't see pawn shops in that number one position, and those are primarily due from Hurricane Harvey. So I think as we reset going forward into the next year, you probably won't see that same ranking in terms of that ratio. On page 128, there's some information on the credit access business data reporting that we provide you on a quarterly basis. And you come see a complete picture of a number of data points related to this. I think one of the big takeaways I take from this report is for the first time since 2013, we have now seen the number of reporting units has stopped the decline and has now started. I mean, it's not much up by much, but we've seen the bottom, it appears, as it relates to this particular issue right now. Of course, there's federal issues that are still pending. We don't know what the outcome is of those at this point in time, but we did see an increase in reporting units from 2017 to 2018. The majority of the new loans that are reported now have completely transitioned into the multiple installment and multiple payment column. You know, previously that we had seen more single installment. Now we are definitely into the majority in the multiple column. And then we've added two data points on this chart, which may be useful to you. It's the very, very bottom line under payday loans and under title loans, the average fee converted to a daily rate. There are some questions before on the average fee per 100 borrowed, and we decided to convert those to daily rates, see if that's more useful information. So, again, that's just for your information. Happy to answer any questions. But moving on to, I already talked about that. On page 130 is the dashboard of the licensing activity. This is all very normal activity. You will see drop off in a number of areas that have just been through their annual renewal cycles, and we see non-renewals and expirations, and those occur in this time frame, and then we usually see those start climbing back up. But those all seem to be generally in a normal activity posture. On page 131 is the report on communications, and there's a bit more detail, sort of again summarizing the year-end activity on the number of stakeholder presentations. There's also a new e-newsletter that was released late in the fiscal year that had emerging issues for Chapter 342 lenders, and that seemed to be pretty well received. We're also instituting a consumer feedback module associated with the license process, a survey upon the completion of renewal registration. So those both went into effect late in the fiscal year. Page 132, I already mentioned a few of the information on turnover, but there's some of the breakdown detail on turnover is on page 132. We saw a lot of interagency transfers in this particular fiscal year. And again, as I mentioned, those were a bit more administrative staff related rather than financial examiner related. On page 134 is information on our information technology. This is a bit more of a more detail in this report about some of the events that the IT was associated with, as well as some of the security issues that I've already mentioned. But also, there's a couple of new security products that are in the process of being installed. Again, just the more tools that we can add to our arsenal, the better things should be. So that's just mentioned there for your information. On page 136, we began talking about some of the performance targets themselves. There's an item on the top of page 136 on monies returned to consumers. That is the restitution number associated with our examination and other type of activity. We'll see that for the fiscal year 18, that number is just over $5 million that was returned to consumers. On page 137 is the full performance report, and I think I previously mentioned we've met 7 out of 9. The two areas where we did not meet the performance measures were in the complaint area as well. Again, we had a decrease in complaints, was the first one of those, and then we've also experienced on page 139 the percentage of complaints resolved within 90 days has begun to stretch out a little bit. Some of those were some complexity. We have a number of complaints that were tied up in some bankruptcy issues this last year. We still are seeing 92% of those complaints resolved within 120 days, but we saw some of those stretch out a little bit longer in the time frames. And then on page 140 is the non-key measures. Those are provided for your information. There's a lot of different non-key measures, and again, we'll be working on identifying improvements to these measures, working with the other agencies, trying to provide more consistent measures throughout the next year as we work to identify those particular issues. But there are some common measures that are there. So that's a really quick run-through of the operational reports. I'm trying to hurry in the interest of time. I'll be happy to answer any questions. If there aren't any, I'm ready to call upon Michael Rigby to give the legal report.
Good afternoon. Michael Rigby, General Counsel for the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner. I'll be going over the legal report, which starts on page 141. I'd like to start off with introducing our new attorney, Alexandra Gullett. You can stand. She is replacing Iman Briggs, who is our primary enforcement attorney. We lost him to the pharmacy board over the summer, and Alexandra is joined us the beginning of September. On page 141, we had one contested case at SOA since the last meeting. This was a motor vehicle sales finance license application that was denied. We had the hearing on August 21st, and we're awaiting a proposal for decision from SOA. On page 142 at the bottom, you see the administrative rule reports. There's basically three rules. One involves pawn shops. The other one involves regulated lenders. Two of those have been taken care of on the consent agenda, and one involving amendments to the pawn shop rules, Lori will be presenting in just a moment. On page 143, there's a summary of the litigation. With respect to the first one, State of Texas versus Cash Auto Sales and VIP Finance, that's up pending at the Dallas Appellate Court. The state filed an appellate brief. The respondent VIP filed a response brief, and then the state has filed a reply brief to that. We have not, it's set for oral hearing, but that's not been scheduled as of today. And then finally on page 144, there's a home equity interpretation request. I have breaking news on that. As of yesterday, that request has been withdrawn. And I'll be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Madam Chair, we are ready to go to rule agenda item number 4. Is it Lori? And we're going to, on page 169, I'd like to ask the Board to proceed with the rule action. Yes, as Commissioner Pettyjohn mentioned, my name is Lori Hobbs. I'm Assistant General Counsel, Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner, and this is our next and last agenda item, I believe, item D4. These are proposed amendments for rules located in Part 5, Chapter 85, Subchapter A regarding pawn shops. And I just wanted to give a really brief overview of this industry before describing this rule action. The OCCC regulates pawn shops and pawn employees under Chapter 371 of the Texas Finance Code. A pawn shop is a business where a consumer may pledge personal property as collateral for a loan. The personal property is then held by the pawn shop and may be bought back by the consumer for a set price within a set period of time. Pawn shops are routinely examined. They must file annual reports, and they renew their licenses each year. Pawn employees are also individually licensed and renew their licenses each year. The process for these particular amendments, in mid-August, we sent notice to stakeholders regarding the review generally of Chapter 85, Subchapter A. And then on September 17th, we distributed a pre-comment draft of the proposed rule text to those stakeholders. On September 27th, we also held a stakeholder meeting and webinar on the proposed changes. We did not receive any written pre-comments on that draft. However, there were, from some who attended the meeting, we did address some of the concerns that they orally brought up during the webinar and stakeholder meeting. So just to summarize a few high points in the actual proposal itself, this implements the changes resulting from the completed review of 7 TAC Chapter 85 Subchapter A that was adopted earlier on the consent agenda. This is a standard review that's done every 4 years under the Texas Government Code. And the proposed changes fulfill three purposes. One, to ensure consistency with current licensing terminology, agency procedures, and streamline processes. Two, to modernize or remove obsolete language, and three, to make technical corrections. So generally, there's several of the licensing rules that have been updated to conform to current procedure and practice, and including the use of the OCCC's online portal. In particular, I wanted to highlight a couple of areas. One is a licensing rule regarding processing of application in 85206E. We have proposed amendments that will allow email delivery of notice of application and protest procedures to a master file email address for existing pawn shops when there is a competing application filed in that county. Currently, we have to, you know, mail those, and so the email will allow some increased efficiencies in that process. However, if the email is not deliverable or an existing licensee doesn't have an email address on file, then we will still send the notice by mail. I also just wanted to highlight some enforcement rules that we're having updated in 85604, 85701, and 85702. These proposed amendments update the agency enforcement procedures and terminology. One thing to note that even before a violation is referred for a potential enforcement action, an applicant or licensee will generally have opportunities to resolve the issue through the agency's other regulatory processes by, for example, sending information to the licensing department, resolving a consumer complaint, or complying with investigation or examination instructions. These rule amendments relate to after the violation is referred to the legal department, and the, you know, those other attempts have not been successful. The first legal action will be an injunction with no penalties. We are moving away from an approach where every violation results in an immediate administrative penalty. We feel this for many first-time violations. This enforcement posture will better allow licensees to bring their practices into compliance without the burden of paying an administrative penalty. So it'd be, those are just some highlights of these proposed amendments, mainly technical and conforming changes. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I'd be curious how many attended the webinar.
I believe it was a little smaller turnout than we anticipated. I think we had about 4 in person and 1 online attendee. 4 to 6 are in that range.
Laurie, I wanted to ask you a question. The area of my trying to understand is 85.604, sort of the migration that we're moving from away from penalties to injunctions and so forth. And Michael, I think I've had this discussion before, so I'm still trying to get my head around what we're doing. And so I'm trying to put 2 hats on. One hat is, as a regulator, what we're doing, and the second hat is, if I were a practitioner, how I would deal with the agencies. And I'm particularly interested and appreciated the comments that you made, Laurie, on the what's going on with the examiner ahead of time. Are there a set of rules around that activity, too? Because in my experience as a practitioner, that's where a lot of mileage can be made, where you have a give and take with the examiner, and perhaps you have a memorandum of understanding that goes in the examiner's notes, or you have something else. But I'm not sure I understand how that activity is captured, if at all, in our rules.
Well, the rules don't particularly cover that. I mean, the entire examination process is confidential and is intended to facilitate that type of give and take and being able to come into, bring healthy licensee come into mm-hmm. compliance. I don't know if perhaps Rudy might be able to address anything further on that. Or?
I'm just trying to understand, mm-hmm. if I'm a practitioner and I come to you and I have a client who is who's come to the end of the examination phase, and it looks to me like it's sort of binary. How does it get to legal? Mm-hmm. How does it get resolved at the examiner? And I don't understand how a practitioner would understand mm-hmm. that. So
yeah,
but on the other hand, I want you guys to be able to do what you need to do. Mm-hmm. So I'm just trying to get my head around how one understands what the process is.
I mean, generally, I know that with a lot of our examinations, there's a first exam and maybe special instructions, and they're given an opportunity to correct those. And then if they don't correct those, then in a follow-up exam, they're more often than not, it's something where it's been cited in more than one exam before it gets to the legal department. I can't say that that's mm-hmm. always the case, depending on the severity of what the issue might be. But typically, there are multiple chances with the exam, maybe extensions, I think, that licensees ask for even on a first exam to comply with the instructions. And so I know that we certainly, do try for those who are making an effort, and we have some who just, they don't respond.
Sure.
They don't provide the restitution. They don't answer the exam at all. And so that's more often the types of cases where we have licensees who are just, they're not responding.
So if you get so the examination comes to the end and there are some findings which may be adverse to the licensee, those are communicated in writing to the licensee? Is that typically what happens?
Yes, there are special instructions in the examination report that say you violated this particular statute or rule. Here's the correction you need to make. You need to refund money to consumers. You need to provide us proof of those refunds.
And so do we invite the licensee to engage in dialogue, or how does that – I just can't get my head around what the process is to deal with the examination. I've never really thought about this before, so I'm
sure.
Just trying to –
Sure. I'd be happy to interject myself a little bit into the process. On the exam side, certainly the licensee – has conversation with the examiner. If there's a position that the licensee is taking that is not consistent, there's a disagreement about mm-hmm. whether or not that is indeed a violation finding. That usually gets kicked up the chain in the exam side, potentially up to Rudy or someone within the examination staff to do another review of that. And we review that, and people can appeal those findings up that through that process to determine. And then they make a policy decision, often, sometimes consulting legal, just to be sure, but they'll make a decision whether they need to modify the examination report or they want to stay with what they have determined as the violation in the exam report. And then if the licensee wants to fight about it after that, then it potentially can go to legal and they can appeal the exam finding.
Okay.
Yeah.
That helps, Sam. Thank you.
Do we have any other questions? If not, then we would request the Finance Commission propose these rules for publication and comment in the Texas Register.
Do I hear a motion to approve the proposal of amendments in 7 TAC Part 5, Chapter 85, Subchapter A, concerning the rules of operation for pawn shops resulting from rule review?
So moved.
So moved by Phillips.
Second.
Second by Will. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes.
Thank you.
Okay. One announcement I do want to make today. As chair, I'd like to exercise my authority in creating a special purpose committee, an ad hoc committee, and the purpose of this committee, which will be formed by the chair of each of our standing committees. So that would be Molly Curl as chair of audit, Will as chair of strategic planning, and Paul as chair of study, to form this ad hoc committee that's purpose will be to work with the efficiency study, digest the results of the efficiency study, figure out a path forward, and potentially make recommendations that will flow to the Finance Commission that would likely occur sometime in the time frame of April to June 2019. And as Charles mentioned earlier, when he gave the Sunset Report, there'll be some recommendations that they'll be making. That committee will work with that as well. And with that, it is 12:49 on October 19th of 2018, and at this time the commission will leave the room, go down the hall, and go into a closed session pursuant to Government Code Sections 551.071, 551.076, and 551.089 to discuss agenda items 10, 11, 12, and 13. The commission will return. The commission is now back in open session. No action was taken in closed session. Any further business, commission members? Okay. In that case, there being no further business, this meeting of the Finance Commission is now adjourned, and the time is 1:27. My apologies for the length of our meeting today.
We have enough chairs for our next meeting.